The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, broadcasting again on a very rainy day. Boy, it was dry for weeks and weeks and weeks here at Edstone, and now it's just been raining quite a lot over the past week, so everything is beautiful and green, just the way that we like it. One comment here from a listener, it says, so thankful for the daily, on-target, unfiltered messages. So blessed to know how it will all end and look forward to the new beginning. It brings me peace. We also got a comment from one of our alert viewers in Manhattan. We've been playing this footage of Manhattan that's boarded up, and she said yesterday that she thinks the date on that is wrong, and we looked into it, and sure enough, the footage was taken back in, I believe, mid-June sometime. The reason she brought it up is she works in Manhattan, and a lot of those, at least those shops and stores on Fifth Avenue, have since been repaired. I guess the glass has been repaired, and many of them have opened. So some small bit of good news, at least for the shops on Fifth Avenue, one of the most famous streets in the United States. But as I've been covering these past 2 days, the news coming out of not just New York, but all of the big cities in the United States, or at least many of them, it's not very good right now. When you look at San Francisco, when you look at Portland, when you look at Seattle, when you look at Chicago, we have a clip from the Chicago mayor that we'll play a little bit later. So it certainly is deteriorating, and we look forward, as I covered on the last two programs, to a time when God will rebuild the cities and turn them into the Garden of Eden that is prophesied there in Ezekiel 36. Well, there's a coup underway in Mali, which obviously is not going to get too many headlines today, the little nation in Africa. But to think about just some of the things that happen as a matter of routine, practically, it's just a kind of a ho-hum story, I suppose. Yet it made me think, when I saw it in the news stack, of the point that the old correspondence course brought out about the 6,000-year history of mankind and how it's been really the history of warfare and fighting and division. That correspondence course, by the way, estimates that there have been 15,000 wars over the course of human civilization. And even if you look at the past, well, what would it be, 80 years or so, 75 years since the end of World War II, on average, there's something like 4 armed conflicts per year, and that's with the United Nations in place. That was the world organization that was supposed to prevent war, right? Coming out of the worst war in human history. And so here's the last chance, as Douglas MacArthur said. This is our last chance. It hasn't been very successful. Now you look at Mali as the latest that you can add to the list. The situation there has been deteriorating for quite some time, quite a few terrorist attacks. And then yesterday you had the coup where these soldiers captured the president, President Keita, I believe is his name. And then hours later, the president announced his resignation and he said, I don't want any blood to spill in order to keep me in power. So he basically gave up without a fight. And some people, as the Telegraph wrote, took to the streets to celebrate. This is from this morning's Telegraph. The news will send shockwaves across the region, which is already buckling under the pressure of the fastest-growing jihadist insurgency on Earth. So this does factor into prophecy, as I'll get to in just a second. It says it was not immediately clear who was leading the revolt, who would govern in Mr. Keita's absence, or what the mutineers wanted. It says hundreds of Malians took to the streets to celebrate. I think I mentioned that. It says later, there are fears that the ongoing mutiny could spell disaster for Mali. The country has been at the center of a grim war spilling out across the arid Sahel region, which runs underneath the Sahara Desert, since 2012. So there's been a lot of conflict there, really, over the last 8 years, as this article brings out. And it talks about how there's lots of terrorist cells that have controlled portions of the country. And the reason it's significant for us to keep our eyes on is that Germany has a strong presence in Mali as well. In fact, Germany has more troops in Mali than it does in Afghanistan. It has more troops in Mali than any other nation in the world. It's only 1,000 troops, but this is important to Germany and of course, to France as well. Like Lebanon, it's a former French colony, and so Emmanuel Macron, again, is taking the lead for Europe in responding to this chaos, but we really want to keep our eyes on Germany, most especially. My father had a couple of articles back in 2013, one of them, Watch Algeria, in which he said, Northern Africa is turning into a battleground with enormously important prophetic implications. He says these terrorists are sponsored, for the most part, by Iran. Iran has designs on being the strongest power throughout the region. So basically what he's describing in this article is the sort of the tug of war between Iran and Germany. Further on, it says, Germany is making strong inroads as well. Both of these powers are racing to get as much control of North Africa as they can. They will inevitably clash with each other. And then he mentions the Daniel 11 clash. Daniel 11 and verse 40. These two powers, the kings of the north and the king of the south, or the king of the north and the king of the south, to clash in this end time. The king of the south, of course, being radical Islam, headed up by Iran. And Germany leads the king of the north. It says here, the orchestrator of the Algerian terrorist attack is from Mali. So here's my father writing 7 years ago about a terrorist strike in Algeria and how that the terrorist cell network came from Mali. It says, Germany has great power in Africa, even military power, that few people are paying attention to. Germany is not about to give that power up, certainly not without a fight. So that's in this article titled Watch Algeria. And then that same year, just a couple months later, my father wrote this memorable piece on the whirlwind prophecy. And that too comes out of Daniel 11 and verse 40. It's from the July 2013 trumpet, where it says, the Germans are excellent war strategists and warriors. They are savvy enough to realize that they will never have peace with Iran. They know that sooner or later, the two religions, their two civilizations, will clash. And so how could Germany do this so easily, so effectively, and so quickly? How could it do it the way it's described in Daniel 11:40, with Germany, the king of the north, coming against the king of the south like a whirlwind and just crushing that power? How could this happen so quickly, so easily, so effectively? Well, he delves into a study of that word whirlwind and explains in that article how Germany is, in fact, surrounding that king of the south. How exactly has the king of the north surrounded the king of the south? Its troops haven't encircled Tehran. It doesn't have bases and aircraft carriers dotting Iran's borders, but it has made some very intelligent, very strategic deployments and deals that give it a presence all the way around Iran's sphere of influence. And then he takes you to maps and he says, look, here's where Germany's presence is. And so that's why, as I say, this is significant. We'll have some additional things to say about this, I'm sure, at the trumpet.com website. Well, yesterday was the second day of the Democrat convention, the virtual convention. Quite a few speakers. I think, I don't know if Bernie Sanders spoke. I know he did the first night. But Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she came out and nominated Bernie Sanders, of all things. So that was an oddity, for one. And then you have John Kerry. He made an appearance talking about how Donald Trump has been horrible on foreign policy. And then, of course, he used to be Secretary of State under Barack Obama. And so then he explained just how wonderful he did as Secretary of State in the Obama administration. They just had a really exceptional foreign policy, particularly for the Middle East. And then you had Bill Clinton speak last night as well. And among other things, he rebuked Donald Trump for transforming the Oval Office from a command center to a storm center. That was from Bill Clinton. And really, if they're going to launch an attack on presidential behavior inside the Oval Office, they have to find someone other than Bill Clinton to lead that charge. But he was one of the many speakers, together with Jill Biden, who gave probably the best speech of the night. I believe it was the last one of the evening. She talked a lot about her family, her life with Joe Biden. She explained how that before she married him, his first wife and their daughter died in a tragic car accident. So she spoke about this in a very touching way, and then talked about the strength and the resiliency of Joe Biden over the years, who's been in politics for decades, and some would say much too long, in fact. But he's been there, and now he's in his mid to late 70s. And I think the thing that stood out in some of the clips that I saw this morning, I didn't watch all of these speeches, but from what I read and what I watched after the fact, here she gives this really touching speech, and then it was made awkward by Mr. Biden entering in at the last. He gave her a hug. He kind of flubbed up his name, some have said, and then at the end, he kind of has a bit of a flub as well. Here's clip one.
Great. Hey, everyone. I'm Jill Biden's husband. As you heard tonight, you can see why she's the love of my life, the rock of our family. She never gives herself much credit. And you know, for all of you out there across the country, just think of your favorite educator who gave you the confidence to believe in yourself. That's the kind of first lady, this Jill Biden will be. God love you.
So some of the commentators, after saying that really it was a pretty good speech, immediately they started to bring up, well, did he say Jill Biden or Joe Biden or Joe Blyden, or what did he say there at the start? And then lady at the end. And so you can add this to a fairly lengthy list of flub-ups over the past many months. And of course, more in all seriousness, the I think two polls in recent weeks that say that a majority of Americans think that Joe Biden is in the early stages of dementia. And so there's a lot of Americans concerned about his mental acuity. And this is just the beginning. That's the thing. We're 75, 80 days away from the election. He's been in the basement for most of this time. Today, this week is supposed to be the big, you know, the big bounce from the Democrat convention. We'll wait and see if that even happens. They were supposed to get the big bounce from Kamala Harris. And in fact, you've heard in recent days that it's President Trump who's surging in the polls, and that Ms. Harris isn't exactly happening. She's not exactly helping, I should say, with respect to stirring up interest in the black community in particular. And what I'm saying is this could really be a slow motion disaster that we're witnessing here. If they get no bounce coming from this, and really when you see or observe just how boring this is, and it doesn't help the fact that they're pre-recording these messages. There's no people there. I think when they announced him as the candidate at the end of the night, the camera switched to him in this school setting, wherever they were, and just a handful of his advisors that were there clapping. This is, I think it was the New York Post this morning that said, this is someone that needs probably 70 million votes to win this. 70 million, and you put together all of these boring speeches. They're very thin on policy, There aren't really any policies to speak of. Other than we're all on board with the radical left. We're all on board with AOC and Bernie Sanders. Outside of that, where's the vision for America? What going forward, what is their plan? We know how much they hate Donald Trump. We know how that they think America is racist through and through. Outside of that, what are they going to do to win over voters? This from Bloomberg, as to even the viewership, says the first night of the DNC drew about a quarter fewer viewers on major broadcast and cable news networks. And you say, well, it isn't quite as exciting without the people. On the other hand, everyone's at home doing nothing. And they're not interested in this. What is their strategy? Their strategy is that America's racist and that Donald Trump is an authoritarian who's destroying democracy. It's not exactly the most positive message in the world. We know what they hate. We know what they endorse as far as the protesting is concerned. The protesters are justified in all of their looting and all of their arsonist behavior. They're stealing, they're smashing, they're destroying. No one in this party has spoken up to denounce that. Just the opposite. You have representatives like this gal, Ms. Presley, from, I think she's from Massachusetts, who's basically there saying, you know, we need this. We need them to rise up in cities like in Portland. This is clip 7.
Right now, we are managing against converging public health and economic crises amid a national reckoning on racial injustice in this country. Communities from Boston to Portland and everywhere in between are rising up to demand accountability and divestment from broken systems.
Rising up, she says. A national reckoning. That's how she describes these riots. They're rising up to demand accountability and divestment. I guess that means defund the police. So it's justified. Here again, are we seeing the early stages of just an absolute train wreck? November 3rd, that's the next election. Do a majority of Americans, are they going to get behind a message that says, yes, destroy the cities, we've got to get the message out. Divestment. It's a moral reckoning. Because of racial injustice. And so they're justified. I think this same woman the other day also said, you know, there should be civil unrest because there's unrest in our hearts or something to that effect. She's calling for it. And then when it happens, well, you have the city officials and leaders that they can't even bring themselves to denounce it, to come down strong on it. Against it anyway. This is the, you know what happened in Chicago a week and a half ago. This is Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot. She's in an interview here and listen to what she says as far as Chicago's struggles are concerned. And then right at the end, listen to what she says about the recent riot on the Magnificent Mile. This is clip 2.
Well, luckily it's minimal. But yes, we do absolutely have our challenges. We have people who are afraid and scared because of COVID-19. We now have literally tens of thousands of people who are unemployed because of the economic downturn occasioned by the shutdowns that were necessary because of the president's failed leadership on COVID-19. And we're dealing with the reckoning across Chicago, as in many cities across the country, related to systemic racism. So we are on the front line of an incredible moment in our civic history.
An incredible moment in our civic history. She uses the same word, the reckoning, like it's deserved. Like this is what we've, it's racial injustice. There needs to be a reckoning. How could you describe what just happened to your city as an incredible moment? An incredible moment in our civic history. That's the mayor of Chicago. Here, the crime in the city is spiraling out of control. And all those shootings, she blames it on guns. No one's held to account. No one's held to the responsibility of their actions. No one accepts responsibility for their actions. It's just a big blame game. It's President Trump's fault. It's the guns' fault. It's racial injustice. It's the policemen. And here they go around toppling these statues, burning down buildings, knocking people unconscious, canceling our culture, canceling our history. And no one stands up to them. The New York City Black Lives Matter leader, Hawk Newsom, he was on Fox last night. Listen to Martha McCollum try to get an answer out of him. She showed him, by the way, the clip of that Chicago area Black Lives Matter leader who said that it's not a big deal, the looting, because we need to feed ourselves. And also these shop owners, they've got insurance. So she plays that clip for Mr. Newsom, and then she's just trying to get him to say, look, can you at least denounce the looting and the arson? And listen to this exchange, clip three.
Do you agree that it's okay to go in and break the windows at Gucci's or Macy's or Nike because it makes sure that that person eats and that person has clothes? That was my question to you. Is that ethically okay to you? Is it?
Okay, and before I answer that, I want to ask you this. Do you think it's okay that America kills people in their homes like Breonna Taylor?
No, I don't think that's okay.
And our politicians do not do anything about it.
And before that, he said, well, what about when America as a nation goes abroad and loots and is also guilty of arson with these other nations? Would you consider that a terrorist movement? In other words, America's a terrorist nation. The police are just indiscriminately killing black Americans. And so I'm not even going to answer you. And if we do, if you are pushed into a corner, well, okay, yes, the looting is justified. In Portland, you had this, I think it's the Multnomah building now, the Multnomah Courthouse. It seems like every few days, Antifa and Black Lives Matter, they sort of change their strategy and target another building. And here, this building's being, it's boarded up for one, and then it's being protected by law enforcement. And listen to the Black Lives Matter activist. Listen to what she's saying to the Portland police. This is clip four.
Your mother's umbilical cord should have wrapped around your neck and choked you just the way you choked George Floyd, you filthy animal. Not only should that umbilical cord should have wrapped around your neck, it should not have wrapped around your neck once. It should have wrapped around your neck two times, not six times or seven times. It should have wrapped around your neck so many times to where you yelled, I cannot breathe. You need to be charged with murder. Yeah. They need to hang you high. Not hang you low. They need to send you to the electric chair and let you fry like a piece of burnt bacon.
Burnt bacon. Well, that if you remember President Trump, he last week talked about how Black Lives Matter got started as a movement 6-7 years ago, where they were out on the street chanting, fry them like bacon, pigs in a blanket, the pigs being the cops, the policemen. She's telling the police there in Portland, I wish you were choked in the womb by your umbilical cord. I wish you were choked to death. You're a filthy animal. You need to be charged with murder. All of them, they're all guilty because of what one police officer did. Everyone's guilty. It all needs to be defunded. And a lot of them are just getting out. They're retiring. Law enforcement's just retiring. Why bother? And then last week, I played the clip for you from that police federation in New York City. And this chief that said, I've been in this for 36 years. I've never seen this organization endorse a president until this year. I've never seen this organization endorse a candidate until this year. It's that bad. We don't want what's happening in New York City to spread to other cities. And this is the platform of the Democrat Party. President Trump, in many ways, is standing alone. Victor Davis Hanson, he brings this out in American Greatness. Standing alone politically, I should say, because there's a growing silent majority that's just terrified and frightened at the thought of these people gaining control of Congress and the White House. Look at what they're doing to our cities. Hanson says, between the abyss and what goes on in Portland and on the Magnificent Mile, there is for the moment nothing else but Donald Trump standing in the breach. Standing alone. Think about 2 Kings 14, this prophecy about an end-time Jeroboam. It says, no president in the history of the Republic has ever been targeted for removal by the opposition party, the permanent bureaucracy, and members of his own party, and in such an illegal and unethical manner. Nobody's been targeted like this. And it's not just coming from Democrats. It's the bureaucracy as well, and even members of his own party. The Democrats this week, they've been pushing out all these never-Trump Republicans to give speeches. They're right on board with the platform of the radical left. No president in history. The Senate Intel Committee came out with its, I guess, its 1,000-page report. And that's headed up, by the way, by a never-Trumper. And so this is similar to the Mueller report. There's nothing much in there. But you had the media, a media that was totally disinterested when that Kleinsmith was prosecuted, or he pleaded guilty last week. They were totally disinterested in the fact that they have someone who admitted to fabricating the evidence that they used to build their case. Trump-Russia collusion. And the Senate Intel comes out with its report yesterday, and now all of a sudden the major media, they're very excited about it, because there's a few little vague things in there about conversations that that the president had with Roger Stone or whoever. And so here's Nicole Wallace on MSNBC returning right back to her. It's a throwback to 2017. Here she is yesterday, clip 5.
But I wonder what we do with the finding that there was this elaborate and intricate web of connections and contacts between Donald Trump's campaign in 2016 and Russia. And we now have on the record half a dozen meetings between Donald Trump, meetings and calls between Donald Trump and Putin, where there are no notes, there were no staffers. John Bolton writes in his book that he wasn't allowed in the room.
The Russians doing everything they can to have their asset remain in the Oval Office, as strange as that sounds. But it's more motivation. So whether it's front and center in the election, I don't know. But I think it should give us all more motivation, because who knows what a second term will be like. I think we do know. It will be Moscow's for the taking.
We will all learn to speak Russian.
Yeah, well, we're all going to have to learn to speak Russian, because that's what the second term is going to be for the United States, for Donald Trump. Moscow's for the taking. And here, Victor Davis Hanson even brings out the fact, he goes point by point on how much stronger the Trump administration has been in opposition to Putin's Russia than Barack Obama's ever was. You know, the infamous reset button and Putin waltzing his way through Crimea, Ukraine, all this aggression. And what have we heard from Russia these past few years? Russia's struggling right now. President Trump's even gotten in there and tried to break up this gas deal between Russia and Germany. They're being hit hard. But you'd never know it listening to the major media. Trump-Russia collusion, round whatever it is, 27. Here we go again. Last week, I've had this clip with my notes for probably a week and a half. But this is Jim Acosta at CNN talking about this investigation into the investigators and the spying, all the spying that President Obama and his team did before and after Donald Trump was elected. Here's Jim Acosta last week, clip six.
And the president also was slamming President Obama, Vice President Biden, accusing them of spying on the Trump campaign. That is just not true. That did not happen, has not been proven.
that one that pleaded guilty last week admitted it. Well, he admitted that they fabricated the evidence so that they could go into FISA and get a warrant to spy on Carter Page. And there's Jim Acosta saying, yeah, that's never been proven, right? Back to this Victor Davis Hanson piece. It says there was the first impeachment. These are the attacks that this president has stood against. There was the first impeachment effort, the Beltway punditry in early 2017, calling for his removal by coup if necessary, the voting machine suits, the Clinton-Obama steel subversion of the Trump campaign and transition, the Hollywood assassination chic, the effort to take out former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, the farce of the 25th Amendment that included the bathos of high federal officials contemplating wearing wires in private conversations with the president, to the psychodrama of Professor Bandy Lee testifying before Congress about Trump's mental state, the silly emolument clause gambit, the subversion of FISA courts, the Russian hoax, Robert Mueller's two-year-long and $35 million witch hunt, the fabricated Steele dossier implanted in the bowels of the Obama government and media, the one phone call impeachment circus, the revolt of the retired generals, and what has rightly lately been called coup porn, the hysteria over Ukraine and caricaturing of Trump in 2020 as Typhoid Mary, Herbert Hoover, and Bull Connor, as the left weaponized the contagion, quarantine, and rioting. Every single crisis, many of them fake, taking advantage of everyone, putting the blame of everyone on Donald Trump. That's the camp that those are the these are the key points of the platform of the agenda. And you can hear it this week in their convention. Hanson says the left, the media, and the never Trump right rarely now anymore argue all of the above was warranted or based on verifiable wrongdoing, but see the mishmash instead as a righteous, any means necessary tactic to achieve the noble end of destroying a president that they detest. And then he says, finally, that Trump is still standing is an unrecognized tribute to his resilience, stamina, and willpower to fight it out to the bitter end. He won't give up. He won't give in to this radical movement. He's the only one with the courage, one of the only, with the courage to stand up and to fight against it. There was some news earlier this week, too, on the COVID-19, this title in particular stood out for obvious reasons. It's from the Daily Mail yesterday. Britain records 1,089 more COVID-19 cases as daily average shrinks for third day in a row, while officials post 12 deaths and figures show six times as many people are now dying from flu and pneumonia. Six times as many dying. And here again, you would never ever know it because of the corrupt media. A media that is just broken. Franklin Templeton Gallup released the findings of its research project yesterday, 6 months into this pandemic. And it says here that Americans still dramatically misunderstand the risk of dying from COVID-19. Now, I mentioned last week or the week before, people here in Britain and some of the misconceptions that they have, suggesting that something like 6 or 7% of the population has died from COVID-19, just way off. Here are stats on Americans and what they think. On average, Americans believe that people aged 55 and older account for just over half the total COVID-19 deaths. The actual figure is 92%. See, Americans think it's about half. Actually, 92%. Number two here, it says Americans believe that people aged 44 and younger account for about 30% of total deaths. The actual figure, 2.7%. Yes, 2.7%. And then another point, Americans overestimate the risk of death from COVID-19 for people aged 24 and younger by a factor of 50. And they think the risk for people aged 65 and older is half of what it actually is. And notice this summary paragraph. These results are nothing short of stunning. Mortality data have shown from the very beginning that COVID-19 virus age discriminates, with deaths overwhelmingly concentrated in people who are older and suffer comorbidities. Now, we've been saying that like a broken record. But still, so many people, they don't have the facts. They don't know the truth. I saw a tweet by Piers Morgan. He's a big fan of lockdown. Lock everything down. We've got to do it to save lives. Well, everything was locked down for months, and it caused a lot of damage. This is from The Federalist. It says, new CDC data on suicide shows Americans can't handle continued lockdowns. One in four young adults, age 18 to 24, reported seriously contemplating suicide within the last 30 days. One in four of young people. And we just tell them to stay locked down. You've got to do it. We've got to do it to save lives. Well, I've got some clips I don't have time to play, but maybe I can get into them tomorrow together with some other material that I've had stack up over the last few days regarding coronavirus and the fact that the figures keep going down, hospitalizations, the deaths, the mortality and all that. And yet the extreme measures taken in France, in Britain, in parts of America, in Australia, in Victoria, Australia, just astounding. The scaremongering, I forget the headline, I think it was from the Telegraph, French quarantine is using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. That's what we're taking to these problems. Never mind that you just crush it totally. We've got to stamp out that germ. French quarantine is using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. That's the way governments in our nations are reacting. Even still, 6 months in, all these misconceptions, all this false reporting. And you had Governor Cuomo yesterday in his convention speech saying that COVID-19 is like a metaphor to where we are in society. In other words, the Trump administration, government in Washington, it's sick. And he said in his speech, by the way, here again, not just like John Kerry, just like any of them would, he praised himself. He talked about how great New York has been in handling this crisis. He said, our way worked, and it was beautiful. It was beautiful, he said. 32,000 New Yorkers dying of COVID-19. 32,000. Between one-fourth and one-third of the total deaths in the United States. And he says his self-assessment, his evaluation of his own work, is that it was a beautiful thing. He's going to write a book about it. It was so successful. Well, we've got more, as I say. We'll tuck some of this away for tomorrow. When we come back, we'll continue with our study, one we've been going through this week, on the importance of growth when it comes to producing spiritual fruit in our lives. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can submit feedback to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress.
They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Over the last few shows, we've talked a lot about 2 Peter 3 and verse 18, where Peter said that we've got to grow in the grace and in the knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And yesterday, I alluded to the importance of being a good steward. God's given us charge over certain responsibilities. He wants to delegate things to us, but he wants for us to be good stewards. He wants for us to take what he gives to us. I've gone through the parable of the talents. We've touched on the parable of the pounds, that nobleman that goes away for a long time, and he gives talents. He gives pounds to his disciples. And then he comes back, and he wants to reckon with us. He wants to see what we've done. Notice 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 1, it says, Let a man so account of us as of the ministers of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Stewards of God's mysteries. In the Revised Standard Version, it says, this is how one should regard us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mystery of God. This is how Paul wanted people to view him in his office. I'm a servant of Christ, and I'm a steward of these mysteries, these precious mysteries that God's made available to us, that God's made known to us. Verse 2 says, moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. And so a good steward, first and foremost, is characterized as one who is faithful. A faithful steward is one who is continually, faithfully doing God's work. He is responsible, after all, for the possessions of the master of the family. The master of the family has turned over his possessions to that steward. And he's evaluating us. He's judging us. He wants to see what we'll do with those precious, precious gifts. Think of it, being responsible for tending to the belongings of God. We are servants of Christ, and servants must be faithful. Let me just take you back to that parable in Matthew 25, the parable of the talents. I didn't get through to the end of it, but you remember what happened there. The first two doubled their talents. And then the last one, the third one, came and said, well, you know, you're a hard man, and you haven't really worked for your return. Notice what happened to that individual. Matthew 25 and verse 28, it says, take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him which has 10 talents. For unto everyone that has shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that has not shall be taken away even that which he has. Imagine saying that to some of these young people throwing tantrums in the streets of America. Well, if you're not going to produce, if you're not going to be a productive citizen in the community, then we're going to take away that which you have and give it to someone else who'll do something with it. You do wonder, what are these young people doing? What do they have going on in their lives? I suppose it's a double whammy. If the government intervenes and says, shut it down. Shut down the places of work, the businesses, the restaurants. You've got a lot of people with a lot of time on their hands. And that's not good. When we're not being productive, when we're not growing, spiritually, when we're not growing, we're dying. That's the lesson here. It says, and cast you, the unprofitable servant, into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. If we don't make gains, this is the lesson from this parable. If we don't make gains, if we stop producing fruit, then we're going to start dying, and we're going to end up losing what we even started with. God will come in and take it away and give it to the one who gained the most. God's a farmer. We'll see that in John 15 if we have time. He's looking for a harvest. He's harvesting produce, spiritually speaking. And so when he gives us his spirit, what a precious gift. When he gives that to us after baptism and the laying on of hands, he expects it to grow. He expects us to use it. Now, just receiving God's Spirit obviously doesn't guarantee our salvation. He wants us, as I say, he wants us to use it. Herbert Armstrong once wrote, "We do not receive enough of this divine power all at once to last forever. It doesn't just sit there in a reservoir. It has to circulate," he would always say, like electricity. We have to go to God, the source of that power, and ask for him to give us more, and then use the Spirit and produce good fruits. Galatians 5, 22 and 23. Human reproduction, it's a perfect type of spiritual salvation. And in the human sphere, you see it start in the smallest of ways with a tiny ovum and then an even tinier sperm cell from the father. But then after that, after it's fertilized, then there is rapid growth. And that's what, even though it starts very, very small, there is rapid growth thereafter. And that has to be our goal, our aim spiritually after baptism. Verse 31, well, this just follows right after this parable of the talents. And then verse 31, it says, "And when the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of glory," the throne of his glory, it says. So Christ is coming back. He's bringing our rewards with him, it says in Revelation 11. He's coming back to reward the saints. We're rewarded according to our works. That's what your Bible says. So what a motivation that should be. Here's what Mr. Armstrong wrote back in 1951. It says, "We are here for the express purpose of learning how to rightly direct the vast powers of God, powers so tremendous the mind of man could not now conceive." It says, "If we are faithful in little things, God will entrust us with big things later on when we're born into his kingdom." It says this life is a training ground. Let's just look at that in Luke 16. If we're faithful in little things, then God will reward us. He'll entrust us with much, much bigger things. That's brought out in Luke 16, verse 10. Jesus said, "He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much." Verse 11 says, "If therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches?" See, how can God trust us with greater riches if we squander away what he gives us in this life the opportunities for growth, to put our hearts into the work. Even the receipt of God's Spirit, that's an awesome power. As small as it might begin, it's an awesome power. But what if we took it and we didn't use it? Or what if we received it and we did not use it? Would God be able to trust us with more power, more responsibility? Verse 12 says, "And if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own?" Again, you think of the parables of the talents and the pounds, and this nobleman that gives these talents and these pounds over to the disciples. Notice now John 15. John 15, this is a wonderful chapter about, about growth and fruit. A beautiful chapter, beautiful instruction coming from Jesus Christ in that final Passover service. John 15 and verse 1, it says, "I am the true vine," this is Christ speaking, "and my Father is the husbandman." So Christ is the vine, or like the trunk of the tree, and the Father, God the Father, he's the farmer. He presides over all. And you can see other scriptures that bring out this same analogy. 1 Corinthians 9, 7 speaks of those who plant a vineyard and eat not of the fruit thereof. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 6, it says, "It is the hardworking farmer who ought to have the first share of the crops." So God, as that ultimate farmer, he wants a harvest. He wants an abundant harvest, one that he can enjoy, one that will make life beautiful and pleasant and peaceful and prosperous for all of mankind. He wants that way of life, in fact, to spread into the universe. Verse 2 says, "Every branch in me that bears not fruit, he takes away, and every branch that bears fruit, he purges it, that it may bring forth more fruit." So if it doesn't produce, it's lopped off, and even if it does produce, there's pruning that goes on so that it can produce more. You see what God is getting at. He wants everyone to produce as much as is possible. Now, he understands there's differences in ability and aptitude, like I covered last time. And some will produce fruit a hundredfold, as the scriptures relate, 60-fold, 30-fold. But God wants to put all of us in a position where we'll yield the greatest possible return on his investment. Verse 3, it says, "Now you are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. Abide in me," verse 4, "and I in you. And the branch, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can you, except you abide in me." So here's the key. We really can't bear fruit unless we're with Christ, unless we're attached to Christ and God the Father. Just like those branches of the tree are connected to the trunk, that foundation. Verse 5 again, he says, "I am the vine, you are the branches. He that abides in me and I in him, the same brings forth much fruit. For without me you can do nothing." If we're abiding in Christ, there's an opportunity there. There's a responsibility even to bear much fruit. Verse 6 says, "If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch and is withered. And men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned." So if we're not attached to that vine, if we stop bearing fruit, then, well, technically speaking, we're no longer in God's church, are we? We're no longer in God's family. We're no longer on God's farm. And God will have to lop us off. He'll have to prune, he'll have to make a big cut on the pruning. And that branch will wither away, because without God, there's no life in us. There's just a temporary physiochemical existence, and that's it. But if Jesus Christ lives in us, if God's Spirit joins together with our human spirit, then we have life. And we can have that more abundantly with each passing day, if we grow Verse 7, it says, if you abide in me, and my words abide in you, you shall ask what you will, and it shall be done unto you. Herein is my Father glorified, that you bear much fruit. So shall you be my disciples. This is what a disciple of Christ does. He bears much fruit. That's what God's after. Verse 16 says, you have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and ordained you that you should go. Go and bring forth fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatsoever you shall ask of the Father in my name, he may give it to you. I have ordained you that you should go and bring forth fruit. This is our purpose for being in so many ways, to produce fruit on God's vineyard. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit some feedback to the program, you can write us, td@kpcg.fm. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.